This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Welcome. Good to see everybody. A packed house. We love this. Thank you for coming out. I'm Greg Johnson, director of the Walter H. Kapp Center for the Study of Ethics, Religion, and Public Life here at UC Santa Barbara. And it is just wonderful to have you all come out, even when the sun is teasing us after days of rain, to come inside. I appreciate that very much. Our guest, whom I will introduce here momentarily, I quipped to him this afternoon. He owes me a certain version of my childhood back, because his narrative of Presbyterians, the FBI, and white nationalism disrupted who I thought I was. Now, growing up in a Presbyterian church with a really large stained glass window, I should add, that was almost entirely white in Colorado Springs, Colorado, I knew something was a little bit off even as a little kid. I was still alive. J. Edgar Hoover was still alive when I was a little kid, so the influence was there. My father read Christianity Today. Nothing so wrong with that. But it seemed real white, real conservative, real limiting in certain kinds of ways that even as a little kid I wondered about. And as I've grown up, I've added some detail and texture to why I maybe thought something was going on there that I didn't entirely understand as a kid. When I first heard Professor Martin speak about this topic, my eyes opened. I realized, wow, there's a deeper substory here that I had no idea about. And I'm sure some of you know aspects of this story, but in its fullness, it's really quite eye-opening and tells us so much about who we are now as a nation, how race is policed explicitly or otherwise, how race gets hinged to notions of religion and well-being for some, but not for all. It's a story that shakes me to the core. I'm not Christian anymore. I'm agnostic on a good day. But I still like to think my childhood was largely a good thing. But I really rethink what it meant to sit in those church pews now and hear the stories I heard and be influenced in the way I was. And that itself isn't entirely negative, but it's the kinds of growing pains we should all be subjected to, I think, in a healthy way. And so I'm grateful for that. I want to thank our co-sponsors, Department of Religious Studies, Department of History, the Center for Cold War Studies, and Legal Humanities. Thank you all for helping make this happen. I want to thank our donors who've supported our work over the years. I want to thank Dusty Hosley, the Associate Director of the Center, for the great work he puts into these events, and our student workers. I want to point you towards a few upcoming events on, March 5th. How Queer Bookstores Shaped the Gay Liberation Movement. This is downtown. We're co-sponsors of this. It's a student in our Mendel Dissertation Fellows Program, Sarah Dunn. So please come out for that. And then just 2 days later, Phil Gorski from Yale University speaking on fragmentation of the sacred. He's really fantastic and is actually an expert in contemporary aspects of white Christian nationalism. And so that dovetails nicely with some of what we'll be doing today. And let me just show you quickly a sketch of some spring events. Anti-Asian Hate, Racial Trauma and Post-Traumatic Growth with Russell Young. A talk story session with Maxine Hong Kingston. This is a co-sponsored event. Black Suicide Studies Workshop, Race, Law, and Asian American Religions. An event with a Native American environmental activist and scholar, Dina Julia Whitaker. And then co-sponsoring the American Indian Indigenous Collective Conference. And then finally, Writing the American Dream, How the Media Mainstreamed Reagan's Evangelical Vision with Diane Winston from USC. Also dovetails in interesting ways with today's event. So please come out for those. Briefly, by way of a land acknowledgement, we're on Chumash land. Most of us know that. We also know that land acknowledgements without follow through are patently meaningless. This university is starting to turn the corner on some important issues by way of our Chumash neighbors and relatives. in the first instance, repatriation, returning human remains to the people from whom they came. And I'm on the committee that's doing that work, and I can report that it's really being done. And I'm proud of that because it hadn't been done for a really long time. The other thing, we're just completing several searches in Native Studies and another one yet to come for senior scholars in the field, and that'll add momentum to the work we do. So the university is making important investments in Native peoples and places in this area. So I want to acknowledge that. I want to acknowledge the ongoing lives of Chumash people, and I hope we, as an institution, have more and more opportunities to welcome their kids to campus. Lerone Martin is Martin Luther King Jr. Centennial Professor in Religious Studies and Director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute at Stanford University. Martin previously taught at Washington University in St. Louis and received his PhD from Emory University. He is author of two books, most recently, The Gospel of J. Edgar Hoover, How the FBI Aided and Abetted the Rise of White Christian Nationalism, 2023, from which he'll speak today. And in 2014, Preaching on Wax, The Phonograph and the Making of Modern African-American Religion. Martin has been the recipient of numerous awards and fellowships, including from the NEH and the ACLS. Most recently, he was awarded a large grant from the Luce Foundation as co-director of the Crossroads Project, a multi-year initiative focusing on the public understanding of African-American religions. It is a great pleasure to have Professor Lerone Martin with us today. Please join me in welcoming him.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks, Greg, for that wonderful introduction. I want to thank you all for coming out this evening. And it was tough to come back inside because after all the days of rain, we finally got some sun. And so I really appreciate you all coming out. I want to thank all the sponsors who helped put this together. First and foremost, Dusty for taking care of me, and Greg for putting up with my schedule as a new dad. I want to thank Greg for that. And I also want to thank the Walter H. Capps Center, Department of History, Department of Religious Studies, Cold War Studies, and Legal Humanities. And a shout out to all the students who came out. I hope that in addition to the extra credit you signed up for, I hope that you get a little something else out of this as well. So let me get started, and so we can have a time for conversation and Q&A. Let me be clear for the grad students in the room. Let me just enunciate what my interventions are here and give you a bit of background about why I decided to write this book in the first place. So first is FBI files. I did not start out thinking I was going to write this book. I started out thinking I was going to write a book on religious radio. And I thought I was going to write about how religious radio shaped the radio industry. And I had a colleague at Washington University in St. Louis who had finished a book on the FBI's surveillance of African-American writers. And so Bill Maxwell said, you know, as you write this book on radio, you might want to check and see if the FBI was interested in any of these radio preachers. And then later that summer, Michael Brown was killed in St. Louis, and I was teaching in St. Louis at the time at Washington University in St. Louis. And I met a number of clergy in the area during the protest in Ferguson. And some of the clergy in the area had told me the FBI had reached out to them to question them around what they were going to do to assist the FBI in making sure the St. Louis region didn't explode. So that got me thinking, how long has the FBI been reaching out to religious faith communities for partnership, for collaboration? So I started making FBI requests, FOIA requests for FBI files, not on clergy that I thought the FBI wouldn't like, which is typically how we think about this. But I thought about making FOIA requests for clergy that I thought the FBI might like. And so that's what began this progress of this book. I started getting hits upon FBI relationships with clergy in America. And so I started thinking about how we could use FBI files, not just to figure out who the FBI was surveilling, but perhaps who the FBI was working with. I eventually ended up having to sue the Department of Justice. And I was and the faculty in here will appreciate this, I was a junior faculty member at the time. I made a request for Billy Graham's FBI file, and the FBI, against FOIA legislation, wrote back to me and said, you know, we don't know if we have anything. If we find it, we'll let you know. But FOIA legislation states that the FBI has to respond within 20 working days. And so they never responded. And so I happened to meet an attorney and who was very kind to me. We were talking about what we were working on. And I told him, and like a good lawyer, when I told him the story, like, yeah, I don't know what I'm doing really. I've tried to request Billy Graham's file. They won't give it to me, and, you know. And he's like a good lawyer. He said, well, you should sue. And I thought, you know, because my father would say, that's the federal government. Like, you don't sue the federal government, you know. So he's like, sure you can, right? He's like, you know, I'll do it pro bono. I'll do it for free. You just have to pay the court filing fee. I was a junior faculty member. This was my research. So I went to my department chair and asked for research money to sue the FBI, right? And Marie Griffith, who was my courageous chair, who I love dearly, she said to me, I'm not really sure you can do that. So, you know, go to the provost. So I went to the provost of the university and said, hi, I'd like research money so I can sue the FBI. And, you know, and I also, please make sure I get tenure. And he said, I'll get back to you. He's like, well, you know, I've read the faculty handbook and it doesn't seem to be anything that says you cannot use research money to sue the FBI. So good luck. And so I sued the FBI for it. And that really opened up the doors to this book. So that's the one intervention I want to make. The second one is for us to think about the FBI and the Cold War, especially as it relates to religion, for those in the Cold War studies. Thinking about the FBI as being an authenticator, an engine of driving certain ideas around the spiritual Cold War. I tried to make that claim in this book, which I'll talk to you in a little bit. And finally, the origins and political rise of white evangelicals. I hope that what my book will do, and I hope to convince you, is the role the FBI played in helping white evangelicals rise in the halls of power and to authenticate their message as the rightful custodians of the soul of the nation. And actually, finally, then, of course, the rise of white Christian nationalism in the 20th century. We've heard a lot about this as of late, and I hope that I'll be able to convince you that the role the FBI played in helping white Christian nationalism rise to the fore as a political force. So I try to do that in the book and with three major parts. Here's part one. Part one is a proselytizing faith. Here's the claim. That J. Edgar Hoover made white Christian nationalism a bedrock of the modern national security state. Now, I recognize fully that the role that J. Edgar Hoover played in orchestrating and structuring the modern FBI, right? There's a great deal of things that Hoover did to organize the FBI to make it what it is today in terms of the sort of landmark representative of law enforcement in the world. But part of that orchestrating and constructing the modern FBI had some liabilities to it and limits to it, and I'm going to articulate some of those today. And part of this comes from Hoover's background. J. Edgar Hoover was born in Washington, D.C., January 1st, 1895. He died there in Washington, D.C., in 1972. He ran the FBI from 1924 until 1972, so almost half a century, J. Edgar Hoover led the FBI. And a great deal of what Hoover brought into the FBI, he learned in his childhood. So I went to the law enforcement museum and looked through his FBI, looked through his personal estate, and I found a number of things. This is his childhood diary at 13 years old. He kept track of a number of things, including the fact that he was elected secretary of Sunday school class. Sunday school meant a great deal to J. Edgar Hoover. It's something he talked about a great deal in his childhood diary. And throughout his life, he saw Sunday school as really being a laboratory or a place where Americans learned religion and citizenship. This is what he said about the Sunday school. He says, Sunday school has instilled within me a spirit of no compromise when dealing with persons and situations opposed to the ideal of a good Christian life. It has endowed me with a keener and deeper appreciation of my responsibilities as director of the FBI. So Hoover really took within this ideal of Sunday school as being something that instilled within him a spirit of no compromise when dealing with people who were opposed to what he understood as the ideal Christian life. And he brought that with him, as he says here, into the FBI when he took over in 1924. He even went further later to say that he felt that the FBI had a Christian purpose, which was to defend and to perpetuate the dignity of the nation's Christian endowment. So this idea that America has at its core, at its soul, a Christian ideal, and Hoover saw the FBI as being a central player in perpetuating that is key to understanding the FBI in Hoover's time, and I would argue even some today. So one of the ways that Hoover did this was he got rid of all the people of color who worked in the FBI at the time in 1924. He got rid of any of the women who were also agents as well. And he reconstructed the FBI by exclusively hiring white Christian males, primarily Protestants and Catholics. He hired and restructured the FBI. He brought in the dress code. He brought in a certain type of structure, which included making sure the agents were from certain schools. He himself had graduated from George Washington University, so he hired a good deal of agents from George Washington University. He hired a good number of agents who were part of his fraternity. He was part of KA, which was, many of you know, was a Southern-based fraternity. He hired men from there, and also Catholic law schools throughout the country, St. Louis University, Fordham University, et cetera, et cetera. And one way that he really tried to make these FBI agents really understand themselves as being Christians who are defending the nation was by making them sign a pledge. He had them sign an FBI pledge, which said in part, I shall, as a minister, seek to supply comfort, advice, and aid to those who may be in need of such benefits. As a soldier, I shall wage vigorous warfare against the enemies of my country, of its laws, and of its principles. So agents in their FBI files that I found during the days of Hoover's early days had this pledge in their file, and they signed it to commit themselves to being Christian soldiers. And one way that he ensured that was to make sure that FBI agents went on spiritual retreats. They went on spiritual retreats named Manresa retreats, which were for some of those of you who are familiar with the Catholic faith. These were named after St. Ignatius, who was a soldier who was converted in a cave in Manresa, who dedicated his sword, who was a former soldier, he dedicated it to Christ. And so Hoover had agents go through spiritual exercises after St. Ignatius to help shape them and mold them into this idea that they would be Christian soldiers. This is a copy of what I found in FBI files. This is an actual sign-up sheet. Those of you would be familiar with when you were maybe in elementary school and you would go on a field trip and mom and dad had to sign a sign-up sheet. But you can see here, every division within the FBI had a retreat captain, so it's very regimented, very ordered about which division had a retreat captain and who was in charge of making sure that people in their division went to the spiritual retreat, and that your name, your section, if you were going to drive, et cetera, et cetera. And all of this, of course, was subsidized by taxpayer dollars, both transportation and the food and everything that was supplied at these spiritual retreats. And at these retreats, agents would go through the spiritual exercises about cultivating themselves to understand themselves as soldiers for Christ. Another exercise that FBI agents went through was an FBI Mass and Communion breakfast. So the FBI would have a Mass, and they would pick a particular person to preach at the Mass. This was open to not just Catholics, but Protestants as well. And the FBI would then invite people to come speak afterwards at the breakfast, which was at a fancy hotel, usually in D.C. Usually people were invited were prominent celebrities, everybody from famous football coaches or celebrities would come and speak. The only person that I found, ironically, who said no to the FBI's request repeatedly was Ed McMahon, the former sidekick of Johnny Carson. Repeatedly, these letters would come to him, and they were very, very, like, these letters sounded very, like, official. These letters would say, you know, like, hello, like, you've been identified by the FBI, would be a perfect speaker for our worship service. Like, we want you to come. Like, please confirm. And Ed McMahon, I've never discovered why, continually said no. But everybody else from Vince Lombardi to celebrities of this nature would say yes, but Ed McMahon said no. So these spiritual retreats were open to FUC, FBI, excuse me, breakfast was FBI employees, their relatives and friends who all gather and worship under the banner of the FBI. Usually Hoover would not attend, but he would send his word or he would write some type of statement to be read to the FBI, their family and friends. Here's one statement that I found in FBI files. It is a pleasure to extend best wishes on the occasion of the 15th annual FBI Mass and Communion breakfast, and the day when a large number of our citizens are completely engrossed in the material things of life. It is a source of deep pride to know that so many men and women of the FBI, their family and friends, gather each year in this now traditional manifestation of their faith in God. Belief in God and his teachings is vital in the fight we daily wage against the insidious forces seeking to engulf us. Without this belief, crime would soon be rampant, and without it, communistic atheism would rob us of our spiritual existence. Let us mold our lives in his image and likeness and strive to uphold the Christian ideals upon which this great nation was founded. John Edgar Hoover, Director. So these sorts of statements would be read at these FBI worship events, and families would hear this, friends would also hear this. So it helped America to see the FBI as these Christian soldiers who are fighting to perpetuate America's Christian ideal. And finally, the FBI also had FBI Protestant worship services, where FBI would travel around the DC area for headquarters and have worship services and Protestant churches along the same way. This religious culture was so embedded into the FBI that I found one FBI agent who had retired to become an Assemblies of God pastor, and he simply said that the Bureau was my seminary, right? That he felt that going through the FBI in some way was like going to seminary, preparing him for the ministry that he then went on to do as an ordained minister. So that's part one of the book. That's the first claim I try to make about this Christian nationalism being a core feature of the FBI through these worship services and spiritual exercises. Part number two. I make a claim that Hoover and white evangelicals partnered to authenticate and materially support white Christian nationalism. The FBI partnered with folks to make white Christian nationalism as the authentic expression of faith in America. As World War II was waging on, Hoover went on the radio and made this claim on NBC Radio, 1942. He said, "The present situation is similar in many respects to those dark days in the early 30s when crime ran rampant and threatened to corrupt the very bloodstream of the decency of America. It is once again the forces of the Antichrist. We should resurrect the plain, strong ideas of our God, our home, and our country. I will lift up my eyes unto the hills from which cometh my help. My help cometh from the Lord." So Hoover compared the World War II and the rise of the Cold War He compared it to what he saw in the 30s, the rise of gangsters, John Dillinger and others. But this is a manifestation of the Antichrist, right? That Hoover was not looking for sociological explanations about the rise of crime, about the rise of certain ideals going on in America or certain vices, right? For Hoover, it was the spiritual battle. That's what he argued was really at the core, right? This Antichrist spirit. And so for Hoover, the only way really to fix this really was this idea of individual salvation, right? There's nothing wrong with America in terms of its structure. What's really wrong is that individual hearts need to come to Jesus and have a spiritual experience. This idea of faith changing American structure, social arrangements, and society was foreign to Hoover. He thought the only true way to be religious was individual conversion. He said this, "I am sure that if more emphasis were placed on the gospel of salvation and less on social justice, the latter would become a greater reality." And that's something, a sentiment we see oftentimes, I think, in public life today. We can see some of our politicians and others saying this, right? That social justice is this evil word, right? What really needs to happen is individuals need to change their heart. And that's how America would be fixed, one person at a time. So Hoover, in order to get this message out, was looking at different outlets. He wrote for Catholic outlets. He wrote for lots of different religious outlets. But the one outlet that he really found an audience and worked really well with him was Christianity Today, which was a very popular Christian magazine that was founded by Billy Graham to really be the mouthpiece of white evangelicalism, founded Cold War, post-World War II era. This is the gentleman who's greatly responsible for much of Hoover's writings. It was Special Agent Fern Stukenbroker. And when Fern applied for the FBI, I got his personnel file, stumbled upon this, right? I wish I could tell you I was digging in the archives and discovered it. I stumbled upon this because Fern Stukenbroker received his PhD from Washington University in St. Louis, where I was teaching. And I discovered his dissertation in the library and realized that he was an FBI agent. And he ended up being one of Hoover's major ghostwriters. When he applied for the FBI, he was like 5'6", 5'7", he was balding. And I looked at his FBI file and all the FBI agents are like, this guy's not cut out to be one of us. He's not handsome like we are. He's short, he's balding. But the one particular FBI agent who was a Baptist layman pointed out that he had a PhD and pointed out that he could be a great writer. And so he was hired in the crime records division in the FBI, which functioned in many ways as the printing organization, or you could argue the propaganda aspect of the FBI to put out information about the Bureau to the public. He was hired, and Hoover at the time was working on a book called Masters of Deceit. It ended up being a New York Times bestseller. Hoover had his agents working on it. Catholics, Protestants, agents were working on this book. It was really technical. He took it, synthesized it, and barreled it down from 800 pages to about 300 pages, and the book sold and became a New York Times bestseller. And from there, he began writing Hoover's homilies for Christianity Today. And he was a Methodist preacher, was very much so involved in his Methodist church. And so he ended up writing several essays for Hoover and Christianity Today. These essays were titles like "The Communism, the Bitter Enemy of Religion." They were often published in Christianity Today. And what the FBI would do was they would connect with Christianity Today. The editor at the time was Carl F.H. Henry. They would connect and they would get together and have a conference and say, what do you want to communicate to your audience, Hoover? And we'll share with you what we want our audience to hear. They worked together and published these essays in Christianity Today, beginning in the 50s all the way until Hoover's death in 72. And I circled here on purpose because these essays, of course, go to people who subscribe to Christianity Today. But then the FBI would use tax dollars to then send these essays out to every FBI field office so that special agents in charge and others could then hand these essays out to the general public. And you could see these essays would have the FBI stamp on the top, United States Department of Justice, Federal Bureau of Investigation, and then at the bottom, reprinted from Christianity Today. And so these essays then are handed out and passed around, not just to subscribers, but the FBI local field offices across the country are handing out these homilies to the general public. And so you get the sense from here that it's Christianity Today, right, that in some ways is speaking for or with the United States government, right, because their way that they're seen as working in cahoots together and being passed around. These essays then, as a result, end up becoming preached and referenced in, from popular preachers. Billy Graham, who had met with Hoover at the FBI office in this photo from 1969, Billy Graham began referencing these essays in his famous sermons like Lost Frontier. He referenced Hoover in his presidential prayer breakfast. And he also would reference Hoover in his radio show, The Hour of Decision. As Billy Graham began repeating some of Hoover's writings, of course, they then filtered into everyday churches and congregations. And I found in FBI files pastors who were talking about how they preached sometimes these essays verbatim, right? So they're taking these essays and preaching them verbatim from the pulpit. Yesterday morning, I preached on guidelines for a civilization in peril from your essay in Christianity Today. This was a letter written to the FBI by a Baptist pastor in suburban Atlanta. Another minister wrote, parishioner wrote, our minister always uses a scriptural text, but this Sunday he used Mr. Hoover's article instead. It was an excellent sermon. America should be deeply grateful for a man with such insight and high Christian ideals. So you see that the way that these essays went from the FBI working with white evangelicals to then being passed around in FBI field offices and then literally being preached from evangelical pulpits to get the to give the idea that Hoover was this Christian soldier, he was leading a Christian force known as the FBI, and then his words are being parroted and spoken from, right, from various pulpits. And the FBI files show the FBI was very pleased with this, right? They recognize that they are in many ways writing the sermons of white evangelical pastors for them, right? So this is a way the FBI works and helps to get its word out, but also, right, helps to authenticate white evangelicals as the right faith expression and also as the rightful moral custodian of the American soul. The final part of the book, I make the claim that Hoover and his FBI were adjudicators of evangelical identity and true faith and allegiance, and that the FBI begins to be a clearinghouse for what is real, authentic faith in American life during this time. Let me share with you a letter from Miss Joyce Carter. Joyce Carter wrote a letter to the FBI stating, Goldwater, Billy Graham, and everybody or group that wishes to runs a daily column in newspapers nowadays. Christians are getting to the point where they fight amongst themselves so much it is sometimes difficult to know who to believe. There are some, there just isn't anyone all different church groups would believe, as well as Republicans or Democrats, except the FBI. I don't believe some folks will believe anything unless it's from the FBI. So this points to, there are countless letters in the FBI files that I found where people are writing to Hoover and seeing him as in some ways functioning as a bishop, right? As a person who can determine what is true faith and allegiance in America. And this is just one example of this letter. Here's another letter written by someone in Butler, Georgia. Dear Mr. Hoover, I'd like any information on the two religious or evangelical associations. One is the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, and the other is the Oral Roberts Crusader. I've heard things about both groups, and from what I've read about you, Mr. Hoover, you are a very religious man. I'm a teenager of 18. I would like any information on these groups, and your opinion of them would be appreciated. Thank you for your time and any help you may be. Yours in Christ. And so you get this, people are writing Hoover and asking him about Billy Graham. They're asking him about Oral Roberts, these really famous religious broadcasters. Maybe they're asking their pastors, maybe they're asking their deacons and their priests, but they're also writing the FBI. Many of us can't imagine writing Christopher Wray. Side note, he's the director of the FBI today, right? And asking for spiritual advice. But this is a very common experience during the Cold War in this country, with people writing and using Hoover as a clearinghouse for what is good faith. The FBI also engages in a well-known effort to discredit other expressions of faith. This is FBI Special Agent William Sullivan. He ran the FBI's Division 5 at the time, which was called Domestic Intelligence. He was a very adamant Catholic. He had spoken both at Protestant and Catholic worship services for the FBI. And he is in charge of domestic intelligence. And he is the one who really spearheads the campaign against Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The FBI engages in a really shameful campaign to discredit King. And part of what happens is that Special Agent William Sullivan, he has done a counterintelligence program against the Communist Party USA. He is, Hoover is telling him that the civil rights movement in this country is filled with communists. William Sullivan says it's not true. We've done a study. King gives the historic I Have a Dream speech at the March on Washington. And the FBI, then seeing the response to the March on Washington, decides that King has to be stopped. And so one of the most famous documents written here is from William Sullivan, who writes after the March on Washington. I'm gonna start from the top there. And this is a very scary sentence for the FBI to ever write, but they're talking about what needs to be done to stop King. As you know, facts by themselves are not too meaningful. Let's just stop there. That's a very dangerous sentence for anybody to say, let alone the director of domestic intelligence. As you know, facts by themselves are not too meaningful, for they are somewhat like stones tossed in a heap as contrasted to the same stones put in the form of a sound edifice. It is obvious to us now that we did not put the proper interpretation upon the facts which we gave to the director. So this is where they're pivoting, saying King is not under communist influence. After the March on Washington, they're now, the domestic intelligence is flipped. At the bottom, as previously stated, we are in complete agreement with the director that communist influence is being exerted on Martin Luther King Jr. and that King is the strongest of the Negro leaders. And as we have stated before in a memorandum, we regard Martin Luther King to be the most dangerous and effective leader, Negro leader in the country. So the FBI decides King is a danger, he is a subversive, and he has to be stopped. And in many ways, this is about a religious battle, and that Hoover sees religion in this country being about individual souls, saving individual souls, and that will keep America, America. And King, of course, calls all of that into question. And King is advocating for a faith that believes in structural changes around not just racism, but war and violence, and also poverty. And the FBI decides that King has to be stopped. So they get permission in October of 1963 from Attorney General Robert Kennedy to bug King. Robert Kennedy writes in the memorandum that King can be bugged at his home or anywhere else he may move, and that is the quote. The FBI interprets that very liberally and decides that King can be bugged any place he moves. So the FBI bugs his hotel rooms, his office space, and other places that King is known to frequent. And they also, as a result, they do pick up, supposedly, and we'll see for sure in 2027, when these files are no longer under court seal. The FBI claims they catch King in a number of places having extramarital affairs. And so they decide one way to discredit him is not, again, to rely on information and facts that will stand up in court or congressional committees, but they decide to engage in a counterintelligence campaign to discredit him before the American people. And so they begin to take what they find on these bugs and try to leak it to journalists, which at that point in time did not publish things like that. And they also try their best to threaten King. And one way they do this is they send King a mixtape of supposed sexual encounters he's had in hotel rooms, and they send him this letter. They send him a letter with the tape, and in part they say, in this anonymous letter, they write it as if it's from an African-American Christian, and obviously no other human being would have access to King's comings and goings in a hotel room, so they send this letter along with the tape, and they say, in part, I will not dignify your name with either a Mr. or a Reverend or a doctor. You are no clergyman. You cannot believe in God and act as you do. The church organizations that I've been helping, Protestant, Catholic, and Jews, will know you for what you are, an evil, abnormal beast pretending to be a minister of the gospel. Satan could do no more. King, there is only one thing left for you to do. You know what it is. You have just 34 days in which to do it. And they sent him this letter prior to him receiving the Nobel Peace Prize. The belief is that it was the hope that King would perhaps either bow out of the civil rights movement or perhaps even die by suicide. You have just 34 days in which to do it. You are done. There is but one way out for you. You better take it before your filthy, abnormal, fraudulent self is bared to the nation. So the FBI sent this to King's home. He received it in January of 65, after he returned from receiving the Nobel Peace Prize. The FBI also tried to use clergy. People like Billy Graham and others spoke out against the civil rights movement, but also used an African-American clergyman by the name of Elder Lightfoot Solomon Mashaw. He was the first minister to have his own television show, and it began in 1947 in Washington, D.C. And they used him, and they would give him information. He would launder it and preach it in his sermons about King being a communist, about King being someone who was a danger to the nation. He even wrote a public letter telling King that King needed to apologize to the FBI for King saying the FBI was not doing its job. And so he worked with the FBI to help to discredit Martin Luther King Jr. And he, like Director Hoover, believed that the best way was really to save individual souls. And so he worked with the FBI to discredit King. All of this was very successful. And we often think of King as the American hero. And of course, he's become that, the only citizen who has a holiday named after him. But at the time when King was alive, there was a survey done in 1965 asking the American public, do you sympathize more with J. Edgar Hoover or Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.? And over 50% of the nation said they agreed with J. Edgar Hoover. And you see only 16% said Martin Luther King Jr. And 21% said not sure. And then this is before King comes out against the Vietnam War. We often think King's popularity takes a dive in this country when he comes out publicly against the Vietnam War, but it happened much sooner than that. The next year, by 1966, a Gallup public opinion poll asked people if they found Martin Luther King Jr. unfavorably or favorably, and 66% of the nation found him unfavorable. And part of this, of course, is because King's advocacy for changing American society and structural arrangements, but it's also because of all the intel the FBI was putting out on the airways and with ministers and other places to say that King was a communist, that he was not really a minister working to perfect America, but he was trying to tear America down. So what does all this mean in my conclusion? The interesting thing about this history is that the FBI every year usually tweets something celebrating the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. This is one tweet that I took. Today, the FBI honors the life and work of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. A quote from Dr. King is etched in stone at the FBI's Academy Reflection Garden in Quantico. That's where FBI agents train. As a reminder to all students and FBI employees, the time is always right to do what is right. So the FBI usually every year tweets something about the King holiday, and now they have a quote of King at Quantico. But I think that part of what this does is obscure the history of the FBI and its role in religion and politics in America. That the FBI still is very much so involved and really is, if we think about, especially going to even thinking about as something as recent as the war on terror, the FBI still exists as an adjudicator of what is true faith, right, in this country, and who is considered a person of faith in this country. And there's still at times a danger in who gets to consult with the FBI, who the FBI talks to learn about religion and politics. Here's one example. The FBI invited the Westboro Baptist Church to a training session, and this was revealed by NPR in 2011, that the Westboro Baptist Church, some of you may be familiar with it, forgive the language, but it's more colloquially learned as the, quote, God Hates Fags Church, and they have been a church that has really promoted the idea that God does not love queer folk, but also that God laughs when U.S. soldiers die in war, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. NPR reported that the FBI had invited Westboro Baptist Church to speak to new agents, right? So there's a question about if the FBI is still engaged in adjudicating faith and politics in this country, which it is, right? What is the role of those of us who are religious scholars, those of us who study religion, and the relationship to the FBI, and how the FBI is going about adjudicating all this today? Right? And this is interesting because the FBI is still very much so, right, a part of our lives. I mean, if you think about network television, the FBI is everywhere, right? Like CBS alone has 3 FBI shows, right? NBC used to have one as well, and so did ABC. ABC had a show called Quantico, right? So the FBI is still a part of our popular culture, and it's still a part of our lives. And it's engaging in some ways in a religion and politics that I would argue is not about expanding the idea of the franchise in this country. Another example is the FBI's leaked intelligence assessment about Black identity extremists. The FBI, this was leaked in 2017, that the FBI was arguing that there was a movement of Black identity extremists who felt they were being discriminated by police, and so that they were engaged in violence against law enforcement officers. And this was not a credible threat, but this was something the FBI put together, a bunch of unrelated incidents that happened in the country as it relates to police in the aftermath of Michael Brown being killed, and was arguing that African-American groups, especially African-American religious groups like the Morris Science Temple and others, were motivated to target law enforcement. And so this was a moment when Black faith and those who were organizing and protesting were being seen and depicted as going against law enforcement. And I've often wondered how we are to think about this as it relates to race and politics and religion today. The FBI has a long history of policing faith communities of color, right? But it seems as if when it comes to white Christian nationalism, there seems to be a blind spot. Right. And oftentimes this even when the FBI has evidence, most recently there was a what happened in January 6th. Many of you are familiar with January 6th. The Proud Boys were a major part of January 6th. And the FBI had several informants within the Proud Boys. But yet January 6th still happened, even though that there was a lot of information and intelligence that this was going to happen. It still happened. So there does seem to be a history within the FBI of over-policing of faith communities of color, but yet it feels as if white Christian nationalism, there still remains a blind spot within the Bureau around this question. And there's a long history for this that I did not go into. The FBI, even during the 1960s and the Civil Rights Movement, actually had an informant within the Klan, many informants in the Klan, but in particular, they had an informant by the name of Reverend George Dorsett, who was the Klan's chaplain. Yes, the Klan had a chaplain, and the Klan's chaplain was an informant, and he worked for the FBI, and his only job essentially was to inform his handler of when the Klan was going to engage in violence. But the FBI still allowed him to be a part of the Klan, to preach a violent white Christian nationalist message, and helped him establish his own Klan called the United Confederate Klans of America, which he promised would not be violent. So the FBI helped him start that Klan. It seems very interesting to me. You think about that history, you think about January 6th and the Proud Boys. Again, we have the FBI with plenty of informants within the Proud Boys organization, But yet, January 6th still happened and was not stopped. Now, Congress is considering a number of bills to think about how, after January 6th, how to stop the rise of white Christian nationalist violence. There's a bill being considered now within Congress called to authorize dedicated domestic terrorism offices within the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Justice, and the FBI to analyze and monitor domestic terrorist activity and require the federal government to take steps to prevent domestic terrorism. Now, I believe that this bill, and those of you who are legal scholars, I would love to have this conversation. I believe that this bill is not necessary. I think the laws are already on the books to police the kind of white Christian nationalist violence we saw on January 6th. I don't think a new law with more legislation, more money, and more potential oversight, I believe, can really be harmful to faith communities of color. I think that the problem here, I would say in closing, is not that this country doesn't have enough resources to stop this problem. It's not that it's because we don't have enough legislation on the books. I think what we are lacking now is the will. Thank you. So I believe we have 15 minutes. Is that what we have? 15 minutes for Q&A. And there, this is being recorded. So I've been told that for questions, you should come to the mic and ask your question here. And I will do my best to respond in kind. So questions. I'm not your professor, but I think if you ask a question, you might get extra credit.
I have a question. Could you just speak to the relationship that the FBI had with conservative African-American churches? Mm-hmm. And if that relationship was favorable, was it due to theology or because they were not supportive of civil rights? Could you speak to that?
Thank you for your question. Hoover, as I mentioned, did really enjoy a strong relationship with Elder Lightfoot Solomon Mishaw, who was an African-American holiness preacher. He enjoyed that his stance on theology, this idea that soul salvation was the way. Mishaw also believed that slavery was a part of God's plan, and he argued and preached over the radio that African-Americans needed to work their way up towards equality. So Hoover loved that message, theologically speaking. So for the preachers who made those types of sermons, yes, Hoover found them useful. The FBI has, you know, memos that say that he's working for us, or he believes the way we believe, that segregation is the proper way to go, or African Americans need to work their way up. Protesting is not the way to go. There were some conservative groups that theologically Hoover enjoyed, but then there were sometimes the complication about some conservative religious groups who did not believe in the draft. So the Church of God in Christ would be one example, a Pentecostal African-American denomination, the first Pentecostal denomination in the country. And many of them during World War I, for example, and after World War I were pushing back against the draft. And so they were considered a bit sketchy because of that, although theologically Hoover would have agreed with them. And I think that that really is a through line as it relates to conservative African-American faith, in that oftentimes theologically they may align with Hoover and other white evangelicals, but that conservative theology oftentimes leads them to different kind of politics. And that for Hoover would be an example of someone who is questionable. You would not participate in the draft. You know, are you a loyal American citizen? So there were some conservative groups that Hoover had his eye on as a result. Student had a question over here. Yeah. Yes, you have to come to the mic. Yeah. Double extra credit for coming to the mic. Book bag and all, man.
I just want to say that I'm very appreciative of your research. I'm a non-denominational Christian, and I really do appreciate the insight on more like the expose of evangelical Christianity and kind of its politics. Yeah. But I was kind of wondering, because I am doing research for a paper and stuff, but what do you think of like the current kind of mainstream Christianity and how it's being pushed today through like PragerU and things like that, rather than like radio stations and popular TV?
Yeah, I mean, I thank you for your question and good luck with your research. I mean, I think that what's really struck me, friend, is the way that some evangelical groups are attacking the teaching of history. I'm a historian, so that's what my attention goes to. And I think that Christian education, in terms of passing along the faith, obviously, as a Christian myself, I think is important. I think it's important, but I'm afraid for the way that some conservative groups are trying to excise anything out of history that doesn't fit a kind of particular narrative. So, for example, thinking about the founding, like America's a Christian nation, we'll show you how that these individuals mention God and you know and some of their reflections or founding documents, right? And the assumption that when founding fathers may mention the divine, that they understand God the same way Billy Graham did, right? And that's just not the case, right? Thomas Jefferson, for example, I mean, you know this. I mean, he, you know, made his own Bible for God's sake. That doesn't seem to be very evangelical, right? So I think that we need to be careful when teaching history and trying to excise things that don't fit our narrative. And I think we also need to be careful about when we teach history and our primary concern is comfort, right? History is not supposed to always comfort us. It sometimes it's meant to unsettle us. And I think in this country, we have that, we don't have that understanding as a large public. We have in other countries examples. We could go to Germany, where the history of World War II, right, and the Holocaust, right? There are public reminders throughout Germany, right, to remind the public of the atrocities and what happened as a way to say, we never want to go back to this again. In our country, it seems as if when we have public history, it's only things we want to lionize. It's only good stuff, right? This person was good, so we're going to build a statue about them. Slowly, this country, as you know, we have museums that are now pointed to some of the more unsavory things and murder and violence that helped to make America what it is. And I think we cannot, as an educator and as a parent, I'm concerned, we cannot raise our children to think that America's always been great, America's always been perfect. That if we're going to teach this history, PragerU and others, that it can't just be things that where evangelicals are always the heroes, right? We've got to teach history and make us uncomfortable. Not to make anybody feel shameful, like that doesn't help anybody to just wallow in shame, right? What we want is to learn from the past so that we can be informed by it and try not to repeat the same mistakes. And so I think that that's my major concern, what I've seen with some more conservative religious groups, and that the story is always designed to make America always evangelical, always on the right side of history, and not the fact that we have to recognize that evangelical faith, especially in places like the South, promoted the slave trade, for example. Like, we need to be honest about this stuff. And that's, I think, what my major concern is. Good luck with your paper, man.
So in the letter that was sent from the FBI to Martin Luther King, it mentioned Jews.
Yeah.
And I was struck by that because in the past, it was all about Christians. So how did it happen that Jews got on the right side of the FBI?
That's a great question. Hoover was very suspicious of Jews. In fact, William Sullivan writes a tell-all book after he is pushed out of the FBI and says that Hoover made an effort to hire one Jewish agent in every field office and put them near the front so that when people would come visit and see, they would see, oh, the FBI is not anti-Semitic. There's a Jew right there, right? And Hoover was found the support that many Jewish and brothers and sisters had for the civil rights movement in this country as subversive. And he thought there was something about the Jews that made them overly vulnerable to communism because of labor activism, because of concerns about equality in this country, especially across the South where Jewish brothers and sisters were discriminated against. He found them to be dangerous and subversive. And then it didn't help any that Martin Luther King Jr.'s close collaborator, Stanley Levinson, an attorney, right, was working with King and helping to edit King's books. And Hoover believed that Stanley Levinson, who had ties with the Communist Party USA in the past, Hoover believed that once a communist, always a communist. And so he didn't really trust them. I think what helped push the FBI more towards moving away from anti-Semitism in part was the rise of the idea of America being a Protestant, Catholic, Jewish nation and trying to differentiate this country from Germany, right? We're not anti-Semitic in this country, right? We recognize everybody. And so Hoover eventually is pushed by the Department of Justice and others to start hiring Jews and people who are not sort of didn't fit the idea of what he thought an FBI agent should be.
Hi, thank you for your research and presentation. I really appreciated it so far. And as for my question, had Kennedy not given the FBI the go-ahead to pretty much poke their fingers into every crevice of King's life, can you tell by the evidence you found how far Hoover or Sullivan were willing to go to defame King, be their findings fictional? Also, was there any defection with the FBI? Was anybody concerned about how Hoover was acting?
So thank you for your question. William Sullivan testifies later in the Church Committee hearings, which there's an investigation, a Senate investigation, which leads to the establishment of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence that we still have today. He testifies before them that he didn't believe any of this, but he was fearful of losing his job. So he said he just went along with it, and everybody in domestic intelligence went along with it because they were afraid to lose their job. It appears that the FBI was willing to do any and everything to discredit Martin Luther King Jr., including, as I said, giving transcripts and sound bites to Lyndon Johnson, who heard these things, to journalists and to reporters and anybody who would they hoped would publish this information. And so they were willing to go to the extent, to any extent possible, really to, sorry, hold on. I'll back up. Any extent possible to frame and discredit Martin Luther King Jr. And it seems as if there was, and I'll quote William Sullivan, he told Congress after the fact that their policy was, quote, no holds barred, unquote, that was their policy to go after him, that any and everything they were willing to do to try to frame him. They used to leak stories to the local press that about King to frame him in an unfavorable way. And even after his death, they worked very hard to stop the establishment of the King holiday. So the answer was that they were willing to go to the ends of the earth in many ways to stop King and the idea of King as an American hero and icon and as a true Christian clergyman who was fighting for the American ideal.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
Hi. The one question I wanted to ask was, I know this seems like a pretty simple question to ask, but like, how was Christianity or like the Christianity that like Edgar Hoover would be J. Edgar Hoover would be preaching, how is that like quote unquote the American like religion or like aligned with like Western values in a sense?
Well, I mean, Hoover would say that it was aligned with it. He would say, for example, in one lecture that he gave, he would say that democracy is Christian and Christianity points to democracy. Or he would say this way, to be an American is to be a Christian, and to be Christian is to be American. That's the way he thought about it. So for Hoover, he sees that the founding fathers are guided by God and guided by Christianity in establishing democracy in the sense that in a democracy, everyone's voice is supposed to matter, every individual matters. And Hoover believed that Christianity was an expression of that because every single soul in Christianity has a decision to make, whether to follow Christ or to not. So Hoover saw democracy and Christianity going well together. He even argued that American democracy was founded upon the Ten Commandments. I mean, he really believed all of these things. So, and these ideas, both in terms of religion, but also in terms of social structure, about patriarchal leadership, that men are the head of the family and men are the head of institutions in this country. Even though Hoover himself, right, never married, never had any children, and had a we could say, a domestic life partnership with Clyde Tulsa. Now, we don't know, we don't have credible evidence that they actually were sexually active, but Clyde Tulsa and Hoover had lunch together every day. They worked together every day. They vacationed together. When Hoover died, he left his home to Clyde Tulsa. At the funeral, when the flag was on top of Hoover's casket, it was folded up and given to Clyde Tulsa as if it was his spouse. But in terms of what Hoover offered and what he spoke about, it was this idea of heterosexual norms, patriarchal norms that he found as the social expression of democracy and Christianity in America.
Thank you.
Hi, Professor. My question regards one of the letters you showed in which this woman says that if the FBI says it, people basically believe it. Yeah. My question is, after JFK's assassination, when there was more public mistrust of federal institutions, from your findings, did that happen with the FBI as much? And to what extent did religion play in increasing or decreasing the trust in the FBI?
That's a great question. Great question. Are you a history major?
Yeah.
Okay. Political science? Excellent. Even better. Great question. You get an A for the day. Actually, for the whole entire quarter. You're like, say it louder, right? Yes. So there's a great deal, you know, this history about the Warren Commission, the FBI, people doubt that the FBI really did a thorough job in investigating the assassination and that the FBI was holding things back. And I think on top of that, there was a lot of rumors swirling around that Hoover didn't like the Kennedys. They were young, they were brash. He didn't like the fact that RFK walked around the Department of Justice building where the FBI was without a tie on. And RFK and his friends would sometimes toss the football around in the office. Hoover hated all that stuff. But there was still a good number of Protestant clergy in this country who supported Hoover and believed that Hoover was a scion of all that was right with America, and that Hoover and the FBI were the only thing really protecting us from communism. So even after Kennedy's assassination, Bobby's assassination, Hoover is still a very popular writer with Christianity today. And he writes an essay and they publish it. He writes it in April, he dies in May. They still publish it after his death and still mourn Hoover as a loss, right? And even though theologically they'll say, Hoover would never give a testimony for being born again. Billy Graham, Christianity Today, they would always ask him, tell me about your born again experience. And he would always say, I was raised in church. So theologically he didn't agree with them, but politically he agreed with them. And so they still lionized him even after some of these events that you're talking about. It's not until the COINTELPRO papers are found and released to the public that Christianity Today and the American public begins to distance itself from Hoover and start to blame all that was bad about the FBI on him and the moment. And so Hoover becomes a sort of historical scapegoat, right? That, Hoover was doing that on his own. But in reality, all the presidents knew what he was doing. Kennedy knew what he was doing. Johnson knew what he was doing. Nixon knew what he was doing. And there was a whole infrastructure in place in many ways that was dependent upon Hoover being Hoover and doing the things that he did. And so the popularity did begin to dip a little bit, but it's not really until after his death and we find out about the counterintelligence program that really does Hoover's popularity take a strong hit. And then Christianity Today distances itself from Hoover and really tries to wipe away Hoover's legacy within evangelicalism. And the last thing I'll tell you is that Hoover received this award from the Chicago Bible Society called the, I'm blanking on the award now, the Gutenberg Award, as someone who was so important and pushing Christian values in America. He gets this award before Billy Graham gets it, right? You go to the Chicago Bible Society website on your phone, you go back to your seat, right? They wiped him clean off of the website. So the years of the award go in sequential order, and then when Hoover wins in the 50s, it just skips. And so that's just an example of how they've tried to wipe him off of from the role he played within evangelicals after we find out and we have proof that he was doing what many people suspected he was doing all along. Finally, what Greg said earlier about the stained glass window, there's a stained glass window at a United Methodist Church in DC where it was built upon his childhood home. It was built on the same location. They, in 1966, they built a stained glass window and named it after him. It's a stained glass Jesus named after him. After people find out that he's been doing what people thought all along, that somebody comes along and takes the plaque off of the outside of the window. So it's no longer seen as the J. Edgar Hoover stained glass window. So that's just another example of the way that his legacy is trying to be wiped clean from white evangelicals. And, you know, even to my disappointment, you know, when this book came out, Christianity Today never reviewed it. They had someone write kind of like a, what's the word? It was kind of like an explanation. Like, there's this new book out that says that all that Christianity Today did with Hoover, but let's be honest, all religious groups thirst for power. We did it and other groups did it too. Thanks for writing the book, Lerone. So, I mean, I'm exaggerating. But you can tell how I feel about it, right? And I was disappointed, but I would argue that that's part of the problem, right? And part of the question that was asked earlier about we really need to reckon with our history. And this is not to wallow in shame again, but it is to be informed by it and hopefully be armed by it to do something about it so don't keep repeating the same mistakes. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for a fantastic question.
Hi. So I am a poli-sci major and a sociology major. And while taking all of these classes about race and resistance and just justice, I always find myself having the same question is, how do we fix it?
Yep.
And I guess my question to you is, you talk about this will. We need to create this will to like make the change. And the laws are in place, but how do we implement it? So my question to you is, how do people like us create the change that we want to see?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that I would argue from my own Christian perspective is that we should use our time, talent, and treasure for what we have towards a particular goal, right? I think justice has demands, but I think those demands for each person are always different depending on your social location, your ability, and the access to power you might have. So I think that history shows us a number of examples of different ways we could do this. We could do this by funding nonprofits. We can do this by organizing nonviolent protests. We can do this by propaganda. We can do this through education. We can do this through citizenship schools, right? I think there are a host of ways that history shows us that people who came before us were able to affect change. And I think the best way for us, first and foremost, is to arm ourselves with that history, to be informed by it, and then to move forward with that history. So as a student, you're a poli-sci major, that can be involved a number of things. If you go into politics, that could be about as an elected official, that could be about as a congressional staffer, right? As a way that you can shape public conversation, right? And bills, policy, think tanks. I think there are a host of ways to do that. And it's all determined by, I think, what your interests lie in. I've always been moved by something that Howard Thurman said, who was a famous theologian and figure who wrote a number of books. The most popular is a book called Jesus and the Disinherited. It's all about the role of seeing Christ as always advocating for those who are marginalized and the disinherited. Howard Thurman has this amazing quote where he says, don't ask what the world needs, right? Ask what makes you come alive, because what the world needs is people who've come alive. And I think that if you ask that question about what makes you come alive and your poli-sci major and your plans for the future, think about that and how whatever you decide to do can be in the service of justice and equality and fixing some of the problems that my generation has created for you. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. Thank you for this wonderful talk. Can you say just a bit about where you see J. Edgar Hoover's hostility to Martin Luther King and similar civil rights leaders is coming from? What did he believe that the Southern states should be able to maintain segregation? Or did he perhaps believe that sure this should eventually be eliminated, but that the, you know, the way in which the civil rights movement was advocating for change was too disruptive and perhaps infected by subversion. So.
Yeah, that's a great question. In 1965, Hoover gives these remarks to off the record remarks to reporters. He tells them that the Klan is disgusting. He says they're vicious, and he literally says, in the areas where they are, you can smell them before you can see them. They're just white trash. He literally says that. But he's like, but the civil rights movement is also equally disgusting because they're trying to like tear up the country. So he says that in the bleeding hearts who have passed the Civil Rights Bill of 64, who are now considering 65 Voting Rights Act, that they're all wrong. They're just bleeding hearts. What we need to do is that African Americans need to get education, they need to fall in line, be good citizens, and eventually they will be granted the rights that white Americans enjoy. But all this protest and stuff, they just need to stop. Besides, when they can vote, most of them don't even vote anyway. So what's the point? So Hoover kind of struck this ideal that he believed that African Americans were innately inferior, but he also didn't really like the Klan because the Klan was taking law into their own hands, right? And he was the lawman. No one was going to break the law but Hoover. And so he found it offensive when the Klan did it. And also it was bad publicity during the Cold War to have American citizens murdering other citizens because of the color of their skin. And then you're trying to tell Russia and the Eastern Bloc, right, that American democracy is superior. So he found African Americans to be inferior. He believed King was a troublemaker. He just didn't really believe that African Americans really had a claim. He thought that they were inferior and that eventually that they would eventually be granted their rights when white Americans saw fit. And he says, and most white Americans are good people. They're just afraid. And so that was his perspective. And so he was a racist perspective, but also a perspective of arrogance in that thinking that only people who were beneath him were engaged in this type of physical violence. He was not really able to see the broader structure that was enacting violence upon people of color in this country. He always wanted to blame it on these backwoods Klan people. And I think you and I both know, right, that that was not the case then, it's not the case now. I taught a class after January 6th called January 6th in American Religion and Politics. And one of the assignments that I had my students do was go to the Department of Justice website and pick a group or a person who was charged with January 6th sedition and to do a presentation on them. And all of the students were amazed. They all assumed the people in January 6th were uneducated, backwards, right? And then they were surprised to find out these were everyday white Americans who got swept up in January 6th, right? And I think that Hoover was similar to that in that he just would refuse to see good upstanding white Americans as engaging in this type of racist violence, even though he himself was one.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at UCTV.tv.